Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
This is Radio K's Real College Podcast, and I'm Liv Riggins, your host for the week. This week on Radio K's Real College Podcast, we're going to be looking at celebrities. More specifically, we're going to be looking at what it's like to become a celebrity, going from being just someone living your regular life to being known by people, being recognized, being seen not as a person, but as a representation of something else, of other ideas that are being projected onto you. Celebrities are looked up to, but are alternately loved and hated, sometimes at the same time. So this week we're going to be bringing you stories about what that feels like to have that happen to you from people who have become celebrities in different ways, whether that's the local celebrities, the U of M's campus that Nathan Fourvoy talked to, or Jeff Rosenstock, the indie musician that Ben Hallam interviewed. We're also going to be taking a look at the role that celebrity played in shaping the image we have today of probably one of the biggest figures, one of the biggest maybe celebrities the world has ever known, Jesus of Nazareth. So that's all coming up here on Radio K's Real College Podcast.
This is like a really sturdy looking recorder you have there.
But yeah. How heavy is this? Like,
it's pretty heavy if you want to feel it.
Oh yeah, this is quality stuff. Quality solid-state recorder.
That's Jeff Rosenstock, a performing artist in person who's been active in the punk and DIY music scenes since 1995 in bands like ASOB, Bomb the Music Industry, and now a project under his own name. Real College Podcast reporter Ben Hallam talked to Jeff about politics, success, and songwriting last May before his show in the Hole Music Club.
The reception to Worry, it was kind of really big getting a review in Pitchfork and then moving to the next summer playing at Pitchfork Festival and kind of moving in like that. How has that reception kind of been for you?
I mean, it's obvious, it's nice, it's a surprise. Like, we're like, this is now our job, and like, we have, you know, we're playing bigger stuff and it's doing well and it's exciting. But I like, you know, there's still, I don't know. I'm adjusting to it, and I don't expect it to be there forever. So I feel like I need to like get comfortable with it before it just like goes away, because it goes away for everybody. But it's really fun playing the shows, and it's been really fun. Like, it's just been really nice meeting people, and I really like all the people who I've met at the shows, and I feel like we have a really positive environment at our shows, and that it's bigger. Just kind of me. Feels like it means that there's like a lot of people who are having like a good positive time away from a lot of garbage and bad stuff that's happening. And I feel really lucky that we get to be the band for these 15 minutes that like provides that space for people, you know what I mean? So it's cool, it's rad, it's exciting. Like, we played big shows on this tour, and they were, and like going into them, I was like nervous just because that's how I'm, like, a nervous person. It was awesome. Like, the big shows were really fun and we had a fun time. It just kind of feels nice, and I feel really grateful for it. And I also know that I just need to get over my stupid mental crap and like enjoy myself every now and then, instead of just like working and warming up and stretching and changing my strings and thinking about this and thinking about that. Yeah. Feels a little bit less like being a real person, which is something that I miss for sure. You know, having just like, I don't know, just talking to people about normal crap that goes on with dealing with the show and stuff. And just like the weirdness of like, instead of walking out and it's like a manageable like 40 or 50 people that I could talk to, it's like hundreds of people, and it's like I can't possibly try and figure out how to like talk to everybody for as long as I feel like everybody deserves to be talked to. And just like having this weird, like this weird, I don't know, thing put that people, I don't know, when people respond to your music, it's like they know you, and that makes a lot of sense, and I understand that. But like, I don't know, sometimes I feel like people give me a little too much credit for being like, you know, whatever. It's just like, I don't know, like I've been an idiot and made a ton of mistakes in my life, and I think that like I feel like when I'm talking to people sometimes it's just like, yeah, like you could talk to me like a normal person, because I screw up all the time, and I've like screwed up plenty of things way worse than you probably have before, you know? And that's all weird stuff that comes with growing. But like, as far as like the people, I think that's something that has really kept me grounded and kept all of us grounded, is that like at the end of the day, we're still 8 schmucks getting in a van and like, you know, talking crap about whatever, like all the time. And it's still just like, we're just in a band with our friends, and it's fun, you know?
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallen.
Jeff Rosenstock's story is the kind of becoming a celebrity story that most of us are probably familiar with. You know, like small musician becomes a bigger star over time after releasing several albums and learns how to deal with that. But there's also other types of celebrities, different celebrities, local celebrities, maybe people who stand out for their different beliefs and their different way of expressing themselves. Nathan Fervoy talks to some of these different types of celebrities here on campus, who espouse beliefs that are unconventional. Here's Nathan with more on how these local celebrities came to hold their unique beliefs and how they came to hold them with such conviction that they had to get out there and had to tell people, and did so regardless of how they came to be seen by the community at large.
Among the most peculiar characteristics of life on campus is the dozens of promotions, advertisements, corporations, scams, religious institutions, campaigns, and motivated individuals who set up shop along the most trafficked corridors of school, hoping to snag a wandering student's attention. For those selling something, a mass of impressionable young people this large is the perfect place to recruit a lifelong customer. Of everyone that descends upon the students, the most unique voices are surely those of individual people like Parnell, a campus minister who can be found most days talking to students and handing out pamphlets regarding Christianity.
Minister. And so I'm an advisor to several student groups on campus that are Christian motivated, and our mission among the finer details is to introduce people to Jesus Christ and to the Bible and to the saving message.
Parnell is perhaps most infamously known for passing out the Myth of Evolution flyers at certain points in the year, though it is only a portion of his mission.
I think it was
another controversial figure on campus this year is Jonathan. Jonathan is younger and a bit more extravagant than Parnell, often carrying signs boasting a myriad of conspiracy theories.
Yeah, could you read the one that you have with you right now, and then just like talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the one I got right now it says fluoride causes cancer.
The messages these men are attempting to spread are far outside the norm and clearly are not accepted by the vast majority of students they speak to. Yet day after day, they continue to preach. Regardless of my opinion of their opinions, I had to admire their resilience and grit, returning to campus again and again, even after days of no visible progress.
I mean, the majority of people I talk to don't respond to the message and treat it like it's, you know, that's nice for you kind of a thing, or worse. But, you know, when I take that back to the Lord and say, you know, you want me to go somewhere else, do something else, I feel like the Lord's saying, no, I want you to stay where you're at, so.
When one single bit of negativity can dissuade me from ever trying something again, I can't help but wonder what thought processes allow one to be so committed to a cause.
It upsets me, and other times I just really couldn't care. But I feel like it's always worth it. I think that, you know, even if I get a disagreement, then at least I can sort of bring the topic into their mind, and maybe they research it more and change their mind later, or maybe they're more willing to talk about it with other people, or maybe they'll badmouth me to other people behind my back, and whoever they say it disagrees with them, and then I've gained. You know, I've informed someone through a third party, so.
My work is an action of faith. You know, it's like I'm I'm called to obey the Lord and to discharge the mission that He's given me. And apparently that mission is a lot about sowing and not a lot about reaping. A lot of, you know, in a sense, in farmer terms, it's, you know, we're working the ground, we're planting the seeds, we're watering the soil. Not a lot of seeing the increase or the harvest. So no, I don't see a lot of people respond to the message and become believers from start to finish. But I believe that, I mean, they say that, you know, someone has to hear the good news about Jesus Christ potentially up to seven times before they take action on it. And so sometimes I'm the first person.
I also wonder, how did you get here, as I talked to Jonathan Parnell? What influenced you to wake up one morning and decide to stand up in front of thousands of people who will all almost certainly chastise you? To this, their answers were simple, similar, and eerily familiar.
Coming to school, dealt with a lot of depression, kind of a lot of anxiety, kind of trying to suddenly be responsible,
yeah.
You know, and thinking I got to know it all, but finding out that I don't know that much, you know. So I kind of went through my junior year, making friends and still partying a little bit and doing all right in school, but kind of like, what's my purpose in life, you know? But I think I put two and two together and realized that I'm an average guy as far as my skills and intellect. And I was thinking to myself, you know, am I going to succeed in this world, or, you know, should I begin to look for something deeper, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I was just searching, and then I met a guy in Kaufman who had a quiz, you know, back then they could give away pop, you know, so answer the quiz, get a free pop, you know, what are the five religions of the world? And so I answered them, got a pop, and the guy started asking me questions about spiritual life, you know, do you believe in God, you know, do you believe in the Bible, do you have a relationship with God, you know, and never had those conversations before, so I said, well, I believe in God. I don't believe in Jesus Christ. I believe the Bible is written by men and is full of contradictions, you know. And he said, well, you ever read the Bible, you know? And I was like, well, no. He's like, well, would you like to?
There was actually also a preacher I should mention. His name is Mike. I want to say his name is Mike, but when I was in college, this guy would stand outside Walter Library and he would stand on like a chair or something and he would just read from the Bible page after page.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it wasn't for him, I would have forgotten. I would have been really lost without him, without just that guy reading the Bible every day. Like, he kept the thought of, he kept God in my mind, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
After I graduated and came back, I've seen him like in Dinkytown a few times. I went up and I told him, you know, how much, like, seeing him read the Bible to while I was in college helped me, I guess. It was inspired me, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I want to inspire others in the same way.
Both Parnell and Jonathan are here on campus because this is the model that was handed down to them. For assurance that what they are doing is having an impact, they need not look farther than themselves. Both learned of what they now preach as students very much like those they now preach to. And so by continuing in place of the preachers that inspired them, they will likely pass the baton down to the next generation. In this sea of many thousands of impressionable young adults searching for answers, only one has to take the bait for the cycle to continue.
Well, there's like four things that I want everyone to know. I'm telling everybody anyways. It's that fluoride causes cancer. There's fluoride in our water. And the Earth is not a spinning ball. Evolution is a lie, an intentional lie. And that God is real. And the Federal Reserve is a private bank. And it's corrupting our country.
Cool. Yeah, all right. Thank you, Jonathan, for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Radio K, Real College Podcast.
As we've seen in Nathan's story, belief and conviction can lead you to become a kind of celebrity. This tie between belief and celebrity is definitely apparent when thinking about Jesus, one of the figures that is probably most well known around the world today. But how did we get the image of Jesus we have today, with brown eyes, curly, long brown hair, beard, mustache? How did Jesus' celebrity image get formed? Max investigates this question, which weaves through centuries of history, from the beginning of celebrity in the Renaissance to the iconoclastic Puritans to questions of inequality today. Here's Max with more.
Imagine a young brown-skinned man that grew up poor, without a father, and ended up getting killed by the very government that was sworn to protect him just because they were scared of him. Now, open your eyes. Who did you see? Maybe Eric Garner, or Freddie Gray, or one of the hundreds of other black men slain by police in recent memory? Well, I'm not talking about them. I'm actually talking about Jesus. Not Jesus Christ, the Son of God, but rather Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of Man. And no, I did not misspeak. I said brown-skinned. I'm here with great pleasure to inform you of some not-so-breaking news. Jesus ain't white.
It's not true. That's impossible!
No! No! I refuse! No!
Oh, save me, Jesus!
I know, it's a lot to take in, but listen, many people, including myself until recently, don't know that, regardless of your religion, it can be historically proven that Jesus was a man that walked the sands of Jerusalem some 2,000 years ago. So if the knowledge is out there that Jesus was a Middle Easterner, why does everyone still think he's white?
When you think of Jesus, how does he physically look to you?
White man with a brown beard and flowing angelic hair.
He has brown hair, he has a beard, and long hair.
Is he white or is he black?
He's white.
A white man with blue eyes and long, like, curly hair.
White man, long brown hair, beard and mustache.
I think Jesus looks like Howard Stern with a flat iron.
Unfortunately, there were no smartphones and selfie sticks in Jesus's time, so we have to rely on artists, painters, and sculptors for our depictions. But if we go back to the first Christian art, we probably wouldn't even recognize the guy.
The early depictions of Christ, he was Middle Eastern, presumably. So it is not determined that he was necessarily a white man. When you talk about early Christian art, there's actually quite a variety of skin tones.
That's Christina Saj, a Christian artist renowned for her modern depictions of classic biblical art. Saj says early depictions of Jesus were so different because the meaning was supposed to be bigger than the man.
These paintings were supposed to represent the other world. And so they were not meant to be realistic in the way that we think of it. We were representing the other world, things that we didn't understand. They were supposed to be somewhat beyond our comprehension. You weren't supposed to be necessarily reflecting back, say, a portrait of a man. It's not that he can't be a man, but he was supposed to be different or better than we were.
Aside from his whiteness, many of the other physical features we associate with Jesus were not a part of these early depictions either. Like, he didn't always have a beard, he wasn't always tall, and sometimes he was downright ugly. It wasn't until around the 12th century that the white surfer dude Jesus that we all know became popular.
Early Christian depictions and icons are not signed. Iconographers generally are not supposed to sign their work because it's supposed to be not about us, it's part of the magic. But in the Renaissance, we come to the place where the cult of personality starts to take over, and artists really start having a persona. People like Leonardo or Raphael, who become known for what they are, and a sort of cult of the beginning of the cult of celebrity takes over. And with that, they infuse their own personal ideals, romantic ideals of beauty.
Well, you know, we hypersexualize everything, and so then we push that back in time. That just didn't come up. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the other writers, they didn't care what Jesus was, what his texts were like.
That's Edward J. Bloom, a professor at San Diego State University and author of The Color of Christ, The Son of God, and the Saga of Race in America. Bloom says that similar to the early Christian artists, Jesus' looks didn't mean much to early Christian writers either.
Our modern obsessions with what people look like, humans haven't always been so obsessed with that. 2,000 years ago, they weren't obsessed with what Jesus looked like. they were obsessed with what he did and what he said. You know, in our culture, like, I have no idea what Kim Kardashian says. I know what she looks like, though. Our belief that all humans at all times have been obsessed with physical appearance, that's just not true. That's us. We're obsessed with physical appearance, and we project that back.
In fact, the only description of Jesus in the entire Bible comes from the book of Revelations, passages 1:14 through 15, where it says, his hair is like wool and his feet are like bronze. So it sounds like he looks more like me, a young black man with an afro, than the long-haired, brown-bearded, blue-eyed Jesus that looks like a guy that could be longboarding on your local campus. Bloom's book focuses on how Jesus has been depicted throughout American history, and although after the Renaissance period he became a staple in biblical art all across Europe, white surfer dude Jesus didn't exactly catch the first wave over to America.
A lot of times people in the United States have thought, well, Americans just painted Jesus just like the Europeans did. And that's actually where the story gets a little disrupted.
Because when people first came over to the United States, they didn't want to depict Jesus at all, right?
Yeah, that's the trick. They were good. They were iconoclasts. They were Protestant reformers who hated everything about Catholicism. And one of the things they hated about Catholicism was all this Jesus art, all these icons. And so the Puritans and the first Protestants who came, they didn't have images of Jesus.
So was it when more Catholic immigrants started to come to the United States that we see Jesus take more of the physical form that we know today?
That was a big part of it. The other issue was after the American Revolution, like, the United States was different. We didn't have a king. You know, we had this new government thing, this Republican government, and a lot of Protestants were really scared because basically the government now was contingent upon people and not tradition. And Christians believe that people are sinful. So we need people to convert to Christianity, become good people so they can be good citizens. Ah, so we've got to get children. Well, children don't want to read the book of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They don't want to study theology, but they might be enticed by pictures. So in the early 19th century, as the United States was growing, a group of Protestant reformers, they basically made their deal. They said, you know what? Pictures aren't as bad as our parents and grandparents would have said. And then they started using imagery. Then those new immigrants, those Catholic immigrants came, and Catholics and Protestants together were using images of Jesus.
And so from his modest beginnings as a short, ugly guy to America's next top model, the image of white Jesus continues to be omnipresent to this very day. Even now, with the internet giving black and brown artists the ability to produce their own colored Jesuses for a mass audience, it's hard to compete with history.
If there are hundreds or thousands of black Jesuses, there are billions of reproduced white Jesuses. The game is not equal. The game looks equal today because we can all go on a computer and things like that, but it's actually because of history structured in such a way that white Jesus is going to win just on his own. I often do this in class. I have my students get out Monopoly boards, and I say, okay, these two people are going to play. And I let them play, and they buy property, and they do their stuff. Now, you two people, you're going to join the game, okay, after all the property's been purchased. After they've passed go and accumulated money and everything. Now, if I enter that game and I roll, land on Ventnor Avenue or whatever it is, I don't get to buy it for $100. I get to spend $1,000 to stay in a hotel. And so that's what, when in our world today, whether it's a white Jesus or issues of wealth differentials between whites and non-whites, we're playing Monopoly games where certain people have been playing and accumulating all the assets, and now it's like, hey, everybody else, come join the game.
At the end of the day, there's very little we can factually conclude about Jesus, but I think it's safe to say he looked less like a surfer hippie guy and more like the guy that would be stopped for a random security check at the airport.
Me and Jesus. Come
for the Real College Podcast, this is Max Fuller.
Cause you know that he's a simply Christ-terrific dude. His eyes are bluish, bright and I love you-ish. And he's also Jewish, but he's not the least.
So that's it for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Real College Podcast is produced by Ben Hallam, Lizzie Ritchie, Tosin Fasimo, and me, Liv Riggins. Our managing host and editor is Nathan Fervoy. You can find us online at RadioK.org or download podcast episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and many other places where podcasts are found.